From WXXI News, this is Second Opinion Live. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, your skin is your body's largest organ, and this hour we're talking about what we put on our skin. So often we think about what we put in our bodies, but how often do we think about what we put on it? Well, we have experts in our studio today who are going to be talking about what we put on our skin. Americans spend about $8 billion a year on cosmetics, and the cosmetic industry uses thousands of synthetic chemicals in products like sunscreen, moisturizer, shampoos, plenty of products made ostensibly for infants and young children. Some of these chemicals are known carcinogens, and the goal this hour is not to make anybody panic. We want to talk about what is, what isn't, and what some of the quantities are. Chemicals that we put on our body, sometimes we wash down the drain as well. So let's talk about all of these things, and we'll answer your questions as always. Let me welcome our guests for the hour. Dr. Lindsay Delahunty is here. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. Delahunty, nice to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Tim Wiegand is here. Tim is the director of toxicology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He is also a volunteer faculty member at the SUNY Upstate Medical Toxicology Fellowship Program. Dr. Wiegand, nice to see you back here.
Thank you, Evan.
Well, welcome. And Second Opinion Live, by the way, is produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center. Major funding for the series comes from the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. And thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help us make shows like this possible. Also, a nice little note to share with you. We're proud to say that Second Opinion is nominated for a National Emmy for Informative Talk Show Host. And it's not me, as much as I'd love to say it's me. It's Dr. Peter Salgo, of course, who's been doing such a wonderful job. And so great to see that the National could win a National Emmy. He's nominated, and that recognition for Second Opinion, well-deserved. Also want to tell you, you can participate in today's conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. You can also find me on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. I want to get some of the basics out of the way with this. So let's start with the basic question on what cosmetics even are. It's a sort of a broad categorical definition. When we say cosmetics, what do we mean?
So a cosmetic is essentially something you put on your skin for physical enhancement. It's not medicinal. It has no physiologic properties, but rather something for beauty, for restoration of the skin, without healing a specific disease.
Okay. Are there, I assume there's all kinds of regulation, testing, vetting, yes or no?
So the FDA doesn't control the release or sale of cosmetics. They do participate in removing cosmetics from the market if they contain dangerous chemicals or dangerous products, but the FDA does not approve release of cosmetics in industry.
Okay. So individual ingredients. I mean, is this the kind of thing where we need to be or should be looking down for an ingredient list at cosmetics? Does that matter? Are there any red flags to look for?
Well, we have chemicals in medicine or drugs that we do test.
Sure.
For example, medications delivered via patch that could otherwise be delivered by mouth, and we do have testing for them. We know that certain chemicals are more toxic to the skin. There's properties that we can predict whether or not they'll cause problems, whether they're more absorbed versus they just sit on the skin and won't cause problems. So I think with some insight and understanding what potentially could cause problems, it at least would guide us to predict or to say this is a chemical that may cause more problems, and that should, you know, if there's some red flags with a particular product.
Okay, lots of terms that our audience may or may not be familiar with, and the host may or may not be familiar with. Dermal absorption, for example. What does that mean?
So the skin is generally comprised of two layers, a top layer called the epidermis and a bottom layer called the dermis. So dermal absorption would refer to a cosmetic or chemicals placed on the skin surface that are absorbed down into the second layer of that skin, or at least wondering if it is absorbed down into the second layer of the skin. So not everything necessarily is, but if you're concerned about internal health and would a chemical or a cosmetic cause a health problem, you would be concerned if it is absorbed by the dermis or the second deeper layer of the skin.
In lay terms, that's just the drug getting into the body through the skin.
Okay. And is it safe to assume that if medication can be absorbed through the skin, that cosmetics, which again, cosmetics defined as not medication, are those chemicals getting absorbed into our through the skin as well in the same process?
I think the bottom line is that yes, probably some chemicals are absorbed. The question is, does it matter? Does it have a health risk or a health effect?
How do we know? that's a great question. Tim?
Well, everything's toxic to some extent. In toxicology, we have an axiom that is, there is nothing that's not a poison. It's the dose that makes a poison. Even water, for example, if you have too much water and you drink exclusively, it can change the body's chemistry and cause all sorts of problems. Or oxygen in the ICU, if you put somebody in a ventilator and give them only oxygen, that can cause problems. So small doses of medications, not significant amounts getting in, not a lot of a problem. And I think, again, it's the right chemical on the skin, not one of the ones that we know potentially could cause problems, not one that has certain features, certain structural elements that may cause more of it to get in, and one that we know would cause problems. So I think predicting the effects plays a role that in trying to understand if there's risk or not.
I had a conversation with someone last week about what we put on our skin and is it putting us at risk, how much is in there, and the question was in relation to antiperspirant and I think aluminum in it, which for years I have heard only anecdotally or only in conversation, hey, I heard you don't want to use antiperspirant. You don't want to use the white solid stick stuff. There's aluminum. It can clog pores. It can, the aluminum can be carcinogenic, et cetera. But, you know, in my own Googling, as an expert Googler, I haven't found anything that confirms that. In general, are you guys concerned about antiperspirant, for example?
Not specifically. I think it boils down to a lot of chemicals in a variety of cosmetics. Certain people can develop reactions, rashes, and such to a variety of chemicals in a variety of cosmetics. If you have had problems with a certain chemical or problems with a certain cosmetic where it does cause a rash or itching, then obviously trying to avoid that cosmetic or that group of chemicals can be important. But for the average patient who's never experienced a problem with it, never had itchy rash, changes in the skin, I don't think that there's any evidence, like you said, to specifically support eliminating that from your use.
Dr. Wiegand, agree?
I agree. There's a lot of individual variation in terms of the reaction, the dermatitis. Sometimes it's even on some of the additives, the scents, the perfumes, and so that there's a lot of variability and it doesn't necessarily mean it's bad for the population as a whole.
In a second, we'll walk through some more of the specific list of ingredients that you might find or common chemicals used in products. But let's just kind of step back again and ask, when it comes to what may or may not be carcinogenic, are there ongoing studies? Are there, you know, pretty good sample size studies? Are you satisfied with scientific literature on this? Do we need to see better? Dr. Delahunty?
I think there just isn't a lot of literature on it. There are small sample sizes, small studies done in a variety of settings, none of which have particularly compelling evidence to, for instance, remove a specific chemical or a specific cosmetic from the general population. Perhaps individual patients can't tolerate certain cosmetics or chemicals, but not on a population level.
Okay. Dr. Wiegand, same?
Yeah. Same. Agree.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's talk then about some specifics here. I want to name some of the common chemicals used in products. What are they and, you know, why they might be used? Parabens, for example. P-A-R-A-B-E-N-S. Parabens. We see that sometimes. Dr. Delahunty?
Right. Parabens are a preservative. So it's a chemical used in a variety of cosmetics, basically so the product doesn't spoil would be a good way to think about it. So it prevents growth of bacteria, and just allows the shelf life to be longer than might otherwise be the case. It is a chemical, and it can be an allergen. So I've seen patients who are allergic to parabens, and thus any cosmetic containing parabens could cause a rash or itching for those patients. So I'd recommend that specific patients who have had these reactions avoid parabens, but I don't think there's a reason for people in general to avoid buying products with parabens.
Okay, and obviously then no known link to cancer that we would say, yeah?
If you Google, for instance, you might find that parabens have been linked to breast cancer, and parabens can be can raise estrogen levels. It's a very low estrogen trigger, for instance. But there are zero studies, zero case reports, specifically with a cause and effect relationship. So while you might find paraben in breast tissue or in somebody who's had breast cancer, it doesn't mean that it's the cause of the breast cancer. And obviously, it's a multifactorial, complex disease where there is just zero evidence at this point to specifically say parabens are a cause of breast cancer. But that is out there, people do think.
And it's easy to find some of these associations. A chemical may raise a certain hormone level, and a certain hormone level may be associated with increased risk of cancer. It doesn't necessarily mean that the chemical used in a particular way even has that same effect. So it's these leaps are where we get the generalizations and some of the associations with.
Okay.
It's a difference between association and causation.
Yes.
Okay, how about PABA? P-A-B-A, PABA, which I often hear in sunblock, and we'll talk in a minute
Correct.
About what it is, but what is PABA?
That's when people are most concerned. So it's a chemical found in some sunscreens.
Okay.
And it's found in chemical sunscreens. So there's a difference between sunscreens and sunblocks. Sunscreens are composed of chemicals that help absorb light rays so that they don't cause sunburn, so that the light doesn't cause sunburn. That's different than sunblocks, which prevent light from even entering the skin. So PABA is a chemical that sort of absorbs sunlight so that the sunlight does not contribute to skin cancer, does not cause skin cancer. Some people are allergic to that chemical, so they use a certain sunscreen and they get an itchy rash from the PABA in the sunscreen. But it is not a generalization to the public at whole to avoid that. Over time, the sunscreen industry has started to use PABA esters, which is a slightly different chemical that's thought to be a little bit less reactive to some people's skin. The bottom line is that if you're trying to avoid PABA because you are concerned about a potential rash or reaction, you could use a sunblock that contains titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, two products that have the sun just bounce off of them. There's no absorption, no chemical absorption.
Generally speaking, when we talk categorically sunscreen versus sunblock, is there one versus the other that is safer?
I wouldn't say necessarily safer on a whole population level. For people who are allergic to some sunscreens and have had rashes or itching from sunscreens, they should use sunblocks. For small children, where you're trying to avoid chemicals and young skin, you should use sunblock.
Okay. Now, let me go ahead and read something that was recently pointed out to me. There's a company called Lululemon that makes, I think, yoga pants? Is that, I don't know well. Is that Dr. Mm-hmm. Delahunty,
you're
familiar?
Exercise clothing.
Exercise clothing, okay. And so they have released a couple of ads, and I see them getting criticized in various news sources for some of the language in the ads. Let me go ahead and read the language that they used in the ad, and we'll see what our guests think. According to one of the ads, quote, "Sunscreen absorbed into the skin might be worse for you than sunshine. Get the right amount of sunshine." That's on the ad.
Well, that's very nonspecific. I mean, sunlight can certainly be helpful with the vitamin D, increasing nutrients, vital nutrients, but there's certainly risks with excess sunlight and exposure. So I think this is a very vague and nonspecific statement that, you know, we have no idea about what they're specifically comparing in terms of amounts.
Okay. Dr. Delahunty?
Yeah, as somebody who sees young adults and old adults alike with skin cancers every day from excess sun exposure, I would say that it's just a false claim. You can get vitamin D from foods. You can get vitamin D from supplementation. But there's no need to get excessive sunlight, you know, more than 15 minutes a day without wearing sunscreen or sunblock. There's just no reason to get your vitamin D from the sun to a degree that could then promote skin cancer.
Okay. The company may say, we're speaking broadly, we're not saying go get sunburned, but it sounds like what the doctors are saying is you see so many people who have had sun damage that maybe is not a great message to send.
That's a dangerous implication. That's right.
Okay.
Perhaps their thought was that wearing their clothing to prevent sun damage, which is fine. You know, it's great to wear clothes as a way of preventing sunburn. Would be the better option for that company, and I think that would be a better way to state it.
In general, is there Well, I mean, I think of people who have had, I think of friends who have had, various forms of skin cancer. It's all melanoma. Is that the category of skin cancer or no?
Melanoma is one type of skin cancer, and that's the brown or black mole that changes. But there are non-melanoma skin cancers that are also sun-induced.
Okay, because I recall, for example, seeing a friend last summer who had, I think, some spots on his arm removed. Now, even on a 90-degree day, he was wearing some light long sleeve, but kind of sort of, I guess, made for sunblock. And are there materials better than others? Are we comfortable with certain materials? Does it make more sense to wear long sleeve these various materials if you've had a problem?
There are definitely sun protective clothings out there.
So do they work?
A variety of companies sell sun protective clothing. They might advertise SPF 50, for instance, as the safety of their clothing, and they work very well. And I guess that's probably the safest thing to do: wear hats, wear long sleeve, wear pants. But if it's a 90-degree day or you're deep in the south where the sun's very bright and hot, it might not be realistic. And I think that's when sunscreen or sunblock might come more into play.
Okay.
Right. The clothing's a mechanical sunblock in a sense.
Okay. And I'm seeing a number of emails from listeners who are just chiming in with sort of related questions. And for example, Mary just wants to know, is there a maximum SPF that works? I keep hearing that anything over 35 or over 50 is not going to provide any added benefit. Is there a cutoff?
So there isn't a specific cutoff, but I tell my patients that you don't need anything stronger than SPF 50. The key is to reapply every 2 hours. So it doesn't matter whether it's SPF 15, SPF 30, SPF 50, you have to reapply. And obviously the SPF factor tells you how protective the sunscreen will be. So I generally like to recommend SPF 30 or 50 because I think they're more protective than 15. But is SPF 75 more protective than SPF 100 or SPF 50? I think beyond 50, it becomes difficult to sort out.
Okay. It begs the question of why those things exist, other than, I guess, if we believe that they work, right? Mm-hmm. But 50 is you wear 50? 50 commonly?
That would be in the summer, yes.
All right. Reapplying every 2 hours, even if you're not in water?
Yes.
Okay. And when people are burned, for example, you hear all kinds of comments that doubles the risk of skin cancer, or that does 80% higher risk of skin cancer for one sunburn or one severe burn. Do we know really pretty specifically just how much one severe burn or that kind of thing can impact our risk of skin cancer?
Well, it's going to depend on the degree of the burn. When you damage the skin either through burns or mechanical trauma, you damage the barrier and you allow for potentially increased absorption of chemicals or any other component across the skin. So it would depend on the degree of the burn.
And I guess every bad sunburn increases your risk. We don't know exactly to what extent, so I don't think anybody can truthfully tell you it doubles your risk or triples your risk, except that every bad blistering sunburn is clearly a detriment to your health.
All right, it's Second Opinion Live, and you're hearing from Dr. Lindsay Delahunty, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. Tim Wiegand, who is the director of toxicology for URMC, and he is also a volunteer faculty member of the SUNY Upstate Medical Toxicology Fellowship Program. And we're talking about what we put on our skin. Before I get to Gary's question, which just came in, I'll also let our listeners know you can call the program with your questions, 844-295-TALK. I see some questions about kids and sunblock. We'll get to that. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you happen to be in Rochester, 263-9994. I am going to be selfish and ask a personal question. I remember coming up to the Finger Lakes long ago before we lived here, visit people who became my in-laws. I got terribly burned 1 year. And I went back. We were actually working in West Virginia at the time. And really, really rough sunburn, which, again, you're hearing, you don't need me to say, not a good idea to begin with, but it happened. And like a lot of people who have had burns, I was looking for some sort of basic comfort. And I put on a kind of, as I recall, it was aloe. It was the only time in my life I ended up in an ambulance. It was the most difficultly painful itching that I've ever experienced. Really, really Hard to describe just the reaction that I had. And so, as you imagine, I've never put aloe on again. And I haven't really been sunburned like that since, thank goodness. But would that have been an allergic reaction, or is that common for damaged skin to have a reaction with a lot of different products, maybe not necessarily an allergy? For example, if I put aloe on my non-burned skin, should I expect the same kind of reaction? What could cause something that discomforting and painful?
It probably isn't an allergy, though you could obviously test a small spot on your arm, say right now when you're not sunburned. But aloe preparations tend to have alcohol in them. That's part of the base of the product. And so if you're very severely burned or have cuts or trauma on your skin and then you put an alcohol-based product on your skin, it probably would burn pretty significantly. So I can't say it wasn't an allergy, but I think it's unlikely to be. More the alcohol base that probably caused the problem.
Well, alcohol is quite irritating. Anybody that's had alcohol in their mouth or used it to wash out a cut, it burns quite significantly.
So probably just a bad choice of what I was putting in. What should, for people who have been burned, are there safe products to put on to kind of calm the temporary problem of a sunburn?
Aloe wasn't a bad choice. Again, it just depends. It can be irritating to the skin if it's very irritated to start out with.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people do go to aloe if they have a sunburn. It's a common sort of home remedy. Depending on how bad the burn is, it's possible that there just isn't a good over-the-counter preparation to help take care of it. So there are obviously prescription medications that can be helpful for the most severe sunburns to make somebody more comfortable. I'm not sure. What would you recommend, I guess, for an over-the-counter?
I've used historically simply aloe. I grew up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a traditional remedy in our home, even aloe.
Yeah.
Okay. Andy just wants to know about the sunblock that we use in our children. Should we be using up to a certain age different products?
So I think in an effort to avoid chemicals, because we just don't know what it's going to do, we don't know that any of them are particularly harmful, it helps to use sunblocks again as opposed to sunscreens. So zinc oxide or titanium dioxide are the two product names to look for as ingredients in sunscreen. They have a more whitish appearance when you put them on the skin. So the cartoons or TV shows where people have sort of a white nose, those are the sunblocks. They're blocking the sun rather than just, you know, getting the sun rays once they come and touch the skin. I think those are the safest ones to use in children. And so there isn't an age in which you should switch to a different kind of sunscreen, except that would be the safest thing to do.
Okay.
Yeah, children's skin is more sensitive than adults. It changes as we age, and kids are more vulnerable not just to the sun particularly, but to chemicals, the absorption of toxic chemicals, for example.
Michael on Twitter writes to us, and I'm missing one detail from his tweet, but I'll read it. Michael says, my wife is a breast cancer survivor, and he says they recommend she uses deodorant free of aluminum. He says there's all kinds of weird stuff in products. He didn't say who they is. I assume he means her doctors. Yeah, sure. But Michael is saying his wife, a breast cancer survivor, got that recommendation. Anything to add? I mean, again, we're working on sort of evidence versus not a lot of evidence or studies, et cetera. Is that a common recommendation for breast cancer survivors that you're aware of?
I heard that just today in my office.
You did?
So I think it is something that oncologists are recommending to their breast cancer patients. I don't know that there's any great studies proving that it's necessary.
Excessive safety?
Exactly. But I think it's just being careful in those patients.
Okay. And Horace writes to us on Twitter, it sounds like there isn't proof that any of these chemicals you're talking about cause significant problems, but there's also no proof that they don't.
I think that's more like it, that everything in moderation is important.
Okay. Gary writes to a separate question, getting away from sunblock products and sunscreen. As we said, there's a difference. He says, can you please ask about DEET in insect repellents? So he didn't say anything more specifically than that, but I assume he just means, is DEET a problem for our skin and for our bodies? I've stumped you. Dr. Delahunty?
I think that it's not necessarily a problem. We say not to use it in young children, infants, that sort of thing, because it's a chemical in very sensitive skin. We don't know exactly what it does, so it is something we tend to say use when a child's older or in adults. But it's weighing the benefits and risks, so bad mosquito bites or bad insect bites obviously can cause a pretty robust reaction too. So DEET is a very good insect repellent. And so I think there's definitely a place for it, definitely a purpose for it. But I definitely have read and do suggest avoiding DEET on young children and infants because of the chemical.
Really heavy application and over-application can cause some problems. Increased absorption, the kids have different skin, as I mentioned, and I think if it's repetitively applied, excessively applied, DEET can cause some toxicity. In addition to the vehicles for some of the mosquito repellents are hydrocarbons, and hydrocarbons are absorbed across the skin as well and have their own degree of toxicity.
All right, and one more quick question before we move into our second half hour and work through some more of our questions and some of our listener questions for our guests. We've been talking about when these kind of products are on our skin, could they get into our body? If they do, is it a problem? But we can also, I think, fairly say that a lot of these things end up getting washed off, washed down drains, you know, bathroom faucets and drains, shower drains, etc. Should we be worried at all about where they're going and what ends up happening to them when that happens?
We're just starting to understand what the repercussions for the environment are. I mean, with prescription medications, not just washed off the skin, but things that we are supposed to take by mouth and throw into the environment because we're done, or they go through our body and they end up in the environment. And we know that there are repercussions. We can see them with hormones, for example. There's been changes in the ecosystem related to the estrogens, for example, that are going into the environment, either through the body or through pharmaceutical waste.
Okay. All right. So let's get a short break in here. And when we come back, I know Rachel on Twitter's got a question. We'll work through some more of your questions and kind of go down the line with more of ours as we talk about what's on our skin, especially where, as we move into warmer months, happily, with our guests here on Second Opinion Live. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, one of the leading contenders for president, Senator Ted Cruz, says that after the attacks in Brussels, we should stop all refugee programs from any country with an al-Qaeda presence. He's talking about beyond just Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and more. Well, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of refugees from those nations in Rochester. We'll talk about the possible impact here.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
A revolution is happening. Cable companies are unbundling. They're offering fewer channels, and some viewers are losing their favorites.
It's nice to sit and watch something about farming and something that you really love, like animals, instead of those goofy Real Housewives.
The changing business of television, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Second Opinion Live, and I'm your host, Evan Dawson. Our guests in studio today, Dr. Lindsay Delahunty and Dr. Timothy Wiegand, they are taking your questions and ours about what we're putting on our skin. Special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helps to make Second Opinion Live possible. You can join the conversation with your questions or comments. Call 844-295-TALK right now, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI in Rochester, 263-9994. Some of you have been finding us on Twitter. I'm there, just at Evan Dawson. You can also use the hashtag 2NDOP, and that is where Rachel found us. Rachel writes, any recommendations for daily lotions or moisturizers and any all-natural options? Dr. Delahunty?
I think the bottom line is you have to find what you like best. So I recommend a daily facial moisturizer with sunscreen. Summer, winter, fall, spring, all year round, SPF 15 or SPF 30, a nice smooth facial lotion you like to put on your skin. The brand doesn't matter to me, but it does help to have the sunscreen in it and get in the habit of doing it all year round.
Okay.
As far as the natural component that you mentioned, again, it's finding something that you like. Natural, just because it's natural or organic doesn't mean that it doesn't contain fragrances or other allergens that some people's skin reacts to. So you could try organic or natural products. You could try things that aren't natural or organic. But if it feels good on your skin and you're able to use it, I think that makes most sense.
Okay. I want to ask about lead. And I want to ask again in a way that I want to remind people what Dr. Wiegand said earlier. Everything can be harmful in certain quantities. And just because something is present in certain places doesn't mean it is automatically harmful at a certain level. But right now, lead's been in the news, as everybody can understand, for a number of reasons. Really starting with Flint, but now you see in the Rochester region, local school districts testing the drinking waters, things like that. And the last thing I want to do is scare anybody unnecessarily. But we can also tell you that in 2010, the FDA found lead in 100% of the lipsticks they tested. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's going on your lips here. So the first question is that a concern? Does that rise to a level, a threshold of possible concern or harm? So lead in lipstick, is it a concern?
The metals have been used as pigments. Some of the salts have vibrant colors, and you know, that's the reason why they're used in cosmetics. And exactly how much, I mean, we know that lead certainly causes problems, delayed neurotoxicity. As it gets into the system, it can cause a lot of unfortunate health effects. But the amount in the lipstick, it would really depend. Is this very trace? What quantity of lead are we talking about? I've been involved in cases where at the hospital we've had either lead or even other metals have been used in homeopathic remedies at much higher concentration than was initially reported, or brought in from outside the United States and caused systemic toxicity. About 3% of the calls, 1 to 3% of the calls to the poison center are related to dermal exposures, to dermal toxins, and some of them certainly are significant. It really depends on the amount of chemical and the type of exposure, and some of the metals in the cosmetics or other products can be concerning. It really depends on how much is in the product.
But I think it's safe to say that for the daily application of lipstick that people have been using for 100 plus years, there'd be very, very little systemic absorption from putting lipstick on your lips.
We shouldn't throw out all the lipstick in our house right now.
I don't think that's necessary.
Okay. Dorothy, by the way, writes to us on the aloe question. She says, why don't people just use non-chemical aloe, as in the actual aloe from a plant? Many natural companies do sell it that way.
I think that works well if that's available. I think it's just often not available to people if they're at the beach or they're somewhere where they don't have an aloe plant around. So I've used that personally myself, and it does work well. And obviously avoid the alcohol base that buying aloe at CVS would contain.
All right. Another question for our guests coming from Twitter. Are there any cosmetic products that are known to use harmful chemicals? Again, similar, a broad-based question kind of covers what we've been talking about, but any cosmetic products that are known to use harmful chemicals? Any ones that right now you'd say definitely don't get XYZ?
I think it depends what harmful means. So again, there are many people with sensitive skin who have had allergic reactions, allergic dermatitis or rash on their skin from a variety of allergens, a variety of chemicals. So if one person in particular has had a sensitivity to a product, then those should be avoided. But I don't think there's anything on the market for the general public that is known to be a widespread cause of concern.
Okay. There's a product, a chemical, I guess. Well, you're going to tell me if it's a chemical or not. It's a component. It's something. Phthalates, P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. Dr. Delahanty, you're smiling at me. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Are we spelling it?
I think the PH is silent, so I think it's just phthalates.
Oh, I can embarrass myself in so many ways. I'm going to call it phthalates, but phthalates, all right. It's found in often color cosmetics, right? I guess fragrance lotions, body washes, et cetera. Phthalates, any concern there?
Again, I think it brings us back to the same point that it's moderation. So the small amount that's in a variety of over-the-counter cosmetics isn't a concern for the average patient. But if people have had an allergic reaction or a dermatitis to this component before, then it should be avoided.
Okay. Perfumes, cologne, et cetera. Similar answer here. For people who wear a lot, is there a long-term concern? I mean, do you advise people to wear sort of lighter amounts? Any concern there?
Well, the vehicle for some of these chemicals are solvents or alcohols. Alcohols, as you found out apparently with the sunburn, is quite irritating in particular to some individuals, and it depends on the concentration. Also, the fragrances can cause dermatitis. People can have different intolerances to the fragrances. So between alcohols and other solvents and the fragrances, you have a lot of chemicals that people are very sensitive to, or just simply can irritate the skin.
I don't think there's a reason to particularly avoid it if you haven't had a problem. But for instance, I don't wear perfume when I'm working because some people are very sensitive to that. And so I think it's just being aware of your surroundings.
All right. So, you know, in a typical day for any of us, at some point we're probably encountering the kind of products that we've been talking about this hour. And someone may wake up, brush their teeth, shampoo and condition their hair, use shaving cream, a moisturizer, maybe hairspray or gel or perfume. Those products on their own, again, we've been talking about the fact that there isn't anything among those list of products where our guests are saying, "Don't," for the population at large, don't go get this, dangerous. But everything taken together over the course of 15, 20, 30, 40 years, there's still not enough evidence for us to say we should be worried about all that stuff, right? Fair?
I agree.
Yeah? Dr. Wiegand?
I agree.
Okay. It also sounds like the more study, the better. And let's talk about a study. There recently was a study out of UC Berkeley and Clínica de Salud de Valle de Salinas, where a team looked at four chemicals used in cosmetics, shampoos and lotions. And quoting from the article, "These chemicals, known as hormone disruptors, can interfere with estrogen and testosterone in the human body." And let me grab the list of what those chemicals were. The list of chemicals: phthalates, parabens, triclosan, and oxybenzone. So what do we make of, first of all, are you aware of the study? And what did you make of that? Dr. Delahunty?
So I'm aware of the study. I think while they found sort of increases of those chemicals in the urine of students or people using them, we don't know what the medical implications are. So it's an interesting study, and they did find a correlation with use of a cosmetic and then seeing increased levels in the urine, but there's no way to tie that into any medical association. Perhaps we'll find some association in the future or some causation, but right now that's completely unknown.
Okay.
Just because the chemical's there doesn't mean it's causing toxicity. It's, as I mentioned before, it's the dose that makes the poison potentially. All chemicals at certain amounts are toxic. It really depends on the dose and the way it's delivered. So just because it's there is not necessarily a concern.
And just laying out a little bit more of the methodology in that study, 100 Latina girls in the Salinas area swapped their cosmetics and other personal care products for new ones that did not include those four chemicals on their labels. Again, phthalates, parabens, triclosan, oxybenzone. And researchers took those urine samples before and after the three-day test, and the girls showed a 25 to 45% drop in the levels of the four chemicals. So we
just don't know what that means.
Right. Okay, so we know that they're having less of those chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Take them away, then there's less of those chemicals.
Right. The takeaway is there's less of those chemicals. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean good or bad long-term
right.
for health.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. What would you, if you were helping design the study, though, and you wanted to get more useful information out of that, what do we need to know then?
You would need to follow a lot more people for a lot longer time, and that would be an incredibly complex study, taking years and years and years, looking at what potential health effects over time could change, comparing them to large group of controls. It would be an almost impossible study to design, given the complexity.
All right. Well, phthalates and parabens we've talked about. Triclosan is an antibacterial agent. Is that right?
You know, I'm not sure.
I don't have as much experience with that.
Oxybenzone, I guess, is a sunscreen agent?
Oxybenzone's in sunscreen. So it's a chemical in sunscreen. So it's found in sunscreens, not sunblocks. So again, if you're trying to avoid chemicals in sunscreens or have an allergy to oxybenzone, which some people do, some people are very sensitive to that chemical, then they can be avoided by using zinc oxide or titanium dioxide sunblocks.
Well, you know, listen, I feel like these are the times when it's so helpful to have guests like we have on this program right now, because we see medical studies, and it is probably easy to overdraw conclusions or to take what is, you know, maybe useful but a small sample size, or gives us limited information, and broaden it out. And so anyway, I think it's important that we hit that, because this is the kind of study that gets a lot of headlines. So thanks for clarifying there. I want to back up and talk a little bit about something else that has been in the news quite a lot I would say quite a lot recently, maybe in the last year or two especially, and that's microbeads. And I'm curious to know, first of all, just in general, your perspective and how often does this come up for you, Dr. Delahanty?
People ask about it a lot, and I think it's interesting technology that perhaps will have medicinal purposes, you know, in the future, a way to deliver a chemical or a nanoparticle, a very small amount of something, into the skin or into the body and have a beneficial effect, just like it could potentially have a harmful effect. So I think the technology is interesting and it's new. So the promise is out there, but obviously people have had the same concerns that if it can deliver something beneficial to the skin or to the body, could it deliver something harmful as well? And along with everything else we've talked about, I think there are just no great studies to support its harm. And there's nothing to support its benefit at this point either, though I think it's promising.
Okay. Well, my understanding is President Obama recently signed a law that will ban the selling of microbeads in soaps and toothpaste by July of next year, 2017. You know, so again, I think a lot of people hear this and they say, wait a second, I thought the recent verdict is microbeads equals bad. Is that overbroad?
I don't know specific studies or what President Obama used to develop this new law. But it's probably that people have had an allergy or have had some kind of reaction to certain toothpastes and certain products that contain these microbeads. And I think it could be hard to sort out which chemical in those compounds is causing the problem.
Sure, and we can talk about it from the human body perspective, but most of what I've read about microbeads and our reporters with the Innovation Trail, I know Need to Know, Helen B. and Duty Hofer has hosted conversations, and they've done great work on this. A lot of the concern about microbeads is environmental. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this may be one of those cases where you can study all you want what it does to the body and get inconclusive, mm-hmm. but the concern probably is going to end up being more environmental. Tim, you're nodding.
So. I think that makes sense. The degradation, they have potential to persist for quite a period of time in the environment as well. So,
okay. So a lot of the message this hour has been moderation is good. You know, don't maybe overreact to certain concerns. Obviously, you know, when we talk about lead and lipstick, don't overreact to that. Don't throw out all your lipstick. But we also get a lot of questions from listeners about natural products, natural lines of products, et cetera. Are there stand-ins for most of these things that you like better, whether it's bug spray or sunblock, sunscreen, different cosmetics, et cetera? Are there natural products that are better options in general?
So natural cosmetics means that it comes from something, or the components of the product are from things in the environment. Nature, animal products, so like beeswax would be considered an organic or natural product coming from an animal or insect. They still contain fragrances or other potential allergens. So just because it's organic or natural doesn't mean that it's safe for everybody. Obviously, it does avoid certain chemicals, and so if people have allergies to certain chemicals, then natural or organic could be beneficial. Mm-hmm. But it's not that you can't react to something natural or organic. You could still have a problem with those products.
And people often equate natural as non-poisonous or non-toxic, which is not true at all. It's just simply comes from a natural source.
I'm going to get through as many of our questions that have come in via email, some of them to the connections page, et cetera, and we'll get as many as we can in between now and the rest of the hour. Kayla writes to us, I have heard the admonition, if you wouldn't eat it, don't put it on your skin. And the skin is an organ, treat it like an organ. How do you feel about that? And if you agree, then how can we say, pick something you like and it doesn't matter what the brand is? First of all, if you wouldn't eat it, don't put it on your skin. Yes or no?
Well, the absorption through the skin is obviously a lot less than the systemic absorption of eating something. So I get the point. I get where people are coming from. But I think it is sort of a drastic association when it's different. The chemical level in your body of eating something is different than the chemical absorption of putting it on your skin.
It's an important distinction. I wouldn't eat sunblock, but I do put sunblock on my skin. And
that's smart.
And neither of our guests are saying no. The skin is an organ. Treat it like an organ.
I think that makes sense. You should definitely have safe practices for your skin, which is why we would suggest sun protective clothing, sunscreen, sunblock, things like that, because you do need to protect your skin to protect your internal organs. It makes sense.
Okay.
Oh, I agree with that. And in fact, the comparison to the stomach or the gut is very interesting. I mean, we have medications that we take by mouth and are absorbed through the gut. We have medications that we place on the skin. They're absorbed through the skin. Very different types of absorption properties, different types of barriers to them as well. So it's its own unique organ in a sense. It's got unique properties and unique potential toxicities.
Will writes to us, would you please have your guests talk about shaving and what will result in a close shave without irritation? Are you ready to make $1 billion?
It's a difficult question without a perfect answer. Obviously, it depends on any given patient and the thickness or coarseness of the hair as far as which products work best. But shaving creams often help minimize irritation. So rather than just using soap or water, using a shaving cream or gel can help minimize the irritation.
Okay. Let's see here. Rachel writes, is avobenzone something to avoid?
It's in the same chemical or in the same line of chemicals as oxybenzone that we talked about. So it is a chemical, can be an allergen, found in many sunscreens, but not sunblocks. So if you've had sensitivity to sunscreens that might contain avobenzone, it makes sense to use a sunblock.
Avobenzone, A-V-O-B-E-N-Z-O-N-E. Rachel, thanks for that question. Mark wants to know, well, Mark says, my mother tanned for years without ever wanting to use sunblock or sunscreen, and I was worried that she was addicted. Can you get addicted either to sunning or to the chemicals that you've been talking about on this program? It's an interesting question. Do we have any evidence of actual addiction?
There are studies showing the psychological benefit of sunlight. So there are such things as little UVB lamps you could have at your desk at work, for instance, that would provide some narrowband, UVB light rays that might help with mood. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know exactly the studies on that, but I do know that natural sunlight can affect hormones and neuromodulators in the brain to make people feel better about themselves. So that is well known. I would encourage people who feel that way to find something else to replace instead of tanning or instead of baking in the sun in the summer, to find something else that makes them happy or provides some benefit.
Right. I think that was an excellent point. Anything that we can derive pleasure from, some individuals will take to excess and have an addiction pattern of behaviors that don't make sense around it, that have some negative consequences. And that's really, I think, you're not addicted per se to the topical agents or to necessarily the sun, although there's certainly a psychological effect, but it's more the behavior and the sequence of events that they're deriving pleasure from and having some negative consequences afterwards and still doing it despite that.
So we're talking obviously about, in Mark's case for his mother, sun tanning. But what about, I guess, perfumes, colognes, those kind of things? Same kind of thing? Any concern
Not that
there?
I'm aware of.
Okay.
An addictive behavior
sure.
related to that.
Okay.
I think you're bordering on certain patterns of behavior, obsessive behaviors, compulsions, for example, the compulsion to continuously put something, a certain fragrance or something on one's skin, and that's a little bit different than an addiction.
Okay. Another listener on Twitter says, love this subject. I use fragrance-free products to avoid migraine triggers. Friends who switch with me keep me healthy. So just maybe kind of related to what's on our skin impacting migraines, I guess. That could be, I mean, I'm somebody who suffers migraines myself, and I'd never thought about fragrance as a, I don't know if this is your specialty, but yeah?
Again, I don't wear perfumes in the office because I think patients could be sensitive to that, either develop rash, develop headache, because of a strong scent. So it's not universal, but some people definitely are sensitive.
Okay, and Emma, hold on one second. Let me just jump back here. I sent a rather long email from Emma and just wanted to, essentially Emma is writing to us saying, can we clarify, just putting on sunblock or sunscreen doesn't fully remove the risk of a burn or sun or cancer from sun. Is that correct?
You can definitely develop develop skin cancer that isn't from exposure to the sun. But the large majority of skin cancers are from significant chronic or severe sun exposure. So she's right in that you can develop melanoma or you can develop certain skin cancers, more rare skin cancers, without exposure to the sun. But most of them come from exposure to the sun.
And should we, part of her point, I think, is that just putting on sunblock or sunscreen isn't a catch-all?
Shade, clothing, stay out of the sun between 10 and 2, you know, 10 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon are all good thoughts to help keep your skin safe. So it's not just sunscreen. It really is a combination of avoiding the sun, staying out of the sun during peak hours, wearing clothing to protect yourself from the sun.
Subject has been what we put on our skin. And so this is maybe tangentially related, but I will just ask, since I've got time, for maybe one more quick question, which is just on tanning beds. Are we going to look back as a society and say, I can't believe we did that? Or are there such a thing as safe tanning beds?
There's not such a thing as safe tanning beds. And we will look back and wonder what people were doing. And there's currently legislation in many states to ban tanning bed use by minors. So it's definitely on the forefront of many legislatures' minds, many physicians' minds. I see skin cancers almost on a daily basis from young people who have used tanning beds for many years of their life.
Daily basis?
It's very common.
Wow.
People in their 20s, things like that, with skin cancers who have tanned.
Wow. Well, so your advice would be there's no amount of tanning
safe
beds
sun.
That's safe.
No amount of safe sun.
No amount of safe sun, no amount of safe tanning beds. Mm-hmm. Okay, covered a lot of ground this hour. I want to mention that our guests both doctors said they're not familiar with this website I'm going to mention, but I'm just going to mention it just in case you want to check out a product list here. It's the Environmental Working Group. So again, they're not necessarily endorsing it, but we've had a chance to kind of check it out. And if you want to just take a look there, the Environmental Working Group has developed a database for consumers. It's called Skin Deep, with online profiles for cosmetics, personal care products, and their potential hazards and health concerns. The website is ewg.org/skindeep, ewg.org/skindeep. Any other parting thoughts for our audience as we get ready to wrap here, Dr. Delahanty?
I don't think specifically I would encourage everybody to obviously protect themselves from the sun, however they feel most safe doing it.
Dr. Wiegand?
Well, I think just reiterate that just because a chemical is present doesn't necessarily mean there's a toxicity. So if people read a chemical buzzword, to really try and interpret it in light of a broader context, that doesn't mean poison.
Well, thanks for your expertise this hour, both Dr. Wiegand, Dr. Delahanty. Great stuff, and a lot of listener questions answered. Thanks for being here. It's been nice having you this hour. Also, thanks to our sponsor, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helped to make today's program possible. And a special thanks to Second Opinion co-producer, the University of Rochester Medical Center. For all the great crew and staff, always puts together a great program here, makes it easy for the host. Thank you, John Andrus, engineer of the broadcast. Thank you very much. And as always, Connections producer Megan Mack, thanks to her. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. Check out Weekend Connections. It's our new podcast. You'll find it on WXXI.org, WXXINews.org/connections. It's a nice wrap-up of the week. I will talk with you Monday afternoon.